A Different Kind of Leader captures insights from diverse leaders in healthcare, public health, and academic settings so that our organizations are in a stronger position to grow, innovate, and meet the challenges of our day. To our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
Today, we are excited to be joined by Dr. Risa Lavizzo-More, a renowned expert in health policy and geriatric medicine. Dr. Lavizzo-More served as president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for 15 years, until 2017 when she transitioned to the University of Pennsylvania. There, she's a professor in the schools of medicine and nursing, as well as the Wharton School. Risa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we start each of these interviews with a quote. What is a quote that embodies your leadership style or your approach to your career?
A quote on leadership by Nelson Mandela. He said, "Lead from the back and let others believe that they are in front." And this is part of a larger piece that he wrote on leadership, where he first described the ways in which he learned to hear the different arguments that people had around an issue as he observed the chiefs in his village mediate differences, and then saw the role of a leader much like a shepherd. It's very much a quote that reflects inclusion, allowing people to feel a part of the movement that you're trying to create, and emphasizes the sort of subtle role that the leader can play as opposed to a very dominant or autocratic one.
I'd love to hear more, and I'm sure our listeners want to hear more about how you got started in your career, your sort of earliest memories of having an interest in your career. You've had many leadership roles and served in a variety of contexts. I'd love to hear that your trajectory and your journey.
Both of my parents were physicians, trained at Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee in the late 40s and early 50s, and they migrated to Seattle when I was 2 years old in search of a better life, less Jim Crow oppression. And they were two of the five African-American doctors in Seattle when I was growing up. So I got to observe them in their practice as leaders in the community. And then when my mother got into her 40s, she got interested in being a medical director of a children's clinic, federally qualified neighborhood health center. And through my junior high school and high school years, got to observe her becoming a leader of a organization that came to really love her in a way that was different from the way I had seen her interact with her patients. But I didn't really think of myself as going down that kind of a path. I really figured I would be in practice, probably be in academic medicine, be a professor, but I didn't see myself as a leader. Early on, as a very newly minted assistant professor, the section chief of my section, geriatric medicine within general internal medicine, took another job, and they offered me the position of interim section chief. It actually awakened me to my possibility of being a leader. It got me the opportunity to work closely with a masterful division chief and be exposed to how academic medicine works at a couple of levels higher than I would have seen otherwise. And it allowed me to kind of test it out without actually having to take it on for real, because I did the job as interim for about a year, and then went back to being a faculty member. It was a great opportunity, and it therefore made me ready to take on the role of division chief a couple of years later. It gave me a sense that this could be something that I would like to do, that I had a knack for it, and it probably brought those opportunities to me sooner than they would have otherwise been something I considered.
Almost training wheels are a taste of leadership in a safe way.
Great way to put it. Training wheels. And the key to that was that I had such a masterful division chief to observe and mentor and coach me. I hadn't had that, it could have been disastrous.
Having that kind of role model as well as possible mentor, I think, can be so critically important. Mm-hmm. So after division or interim division chief and then division chief, can you say more about your path?
Well, at that point, I came to understand that I was going to have to make some hard choices because I was passionate about expanding healthcare coverage and reducing disparities. And I always felt that it would be important to have a position in the federal government to do that. I had to decide whether I was really serious about trying to change policy at a federal level or continue on the pathway of promotion in an academic setting. And I think leaders often have those very stark choices to make about what direction they're going to go, whether they're going to take risks that might give them a chance to make a big difference, maybe won't, but at least whether you're willing to take the risk and go for it. And ultimately, I decided that here was a chance to work on policy at a federal level and to learn how the federal government works. And so I took the job. Most people will remember that roughly a year after that, Clinton bested George H.W. Bush, and everyone who was a political appointee had to resign. Fortunately was not a political appointee, and so I stayed on in the Clinton administration where the emphasis on healthcare reform became the primary and most immediate agenda item for the new administration. So all of a sudden, I had the opportunity to not just work within HHS, but to work within the White House to see how things got crafted between an administration and the Congress, and what happens when a major policy initiative of a president fails. So all of those turned out to be enormously important for the way I thought about my leadership later on at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and then back at Penn before I took the job at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
How do you make the decisions about the opportunities you take hold of versus those that you let pass?
I always try to think about whether there's going to be the possibility to make a difference consistent with the things that I've always said were important to me personally to do. I think having a vision and a kind of a strategy related to that personally is from an early stage in your career is helpful because then it allows you to say, well, this opportunity in the federal government would be a positive step in being able to do that. And so it's worth the risk. What would happen if I didn't get the job as CEO? Would I be able to go back to Penn? Did I have a plan B? And if I could convince myself that it was something that would lead to the potential to do more and to improve health and reduce disparities, expand access, and there was a way to mitigate the risk, particularly since, you know, throughout all of this, I had a family and a husband, and I didn't want to just crash and burn. So those two things, if I could satisfy those two criteria, then I was usually willing to move forward.
I love the idea of I think you said a personal vision and strategy, almost a personal strategic plan.
Yeah, I can describe it that way now. If you had asked me 30 years ago, what is your personal vision and strategic plan, I probably would have stammered a bit, but now in retrospect, I can see the thread. And that's why I would advocate trying to think that way to people who are at an earlier stage in their career.
I wondered, and I guess I heard in some of your comments, the idea of values and principles. You talked about health equity, making a difference on a larger scale. Are those elements of your sort of personal vision?
Yes. I came to understand, although I probably wouldn't have been able to articulate it quite this way at a fairly early stage in my career, that the things that we call social determinants really do make a difference in whether a person is able to get healthy and stay healthy. I often talk about a patient that I took care of in my residency who was a veteran, a female veteran, who used to come into the hospital all the time with chronic leg ulcers. And she's homeless. She obviously had insurance because she was a vet, but she had no social network. She had severe depression that waxed and waned. And we would treat the acute problem, give her some antibiotics and a warm night in the bed in the hospital, but then the next day she had to go. And I, after seeing that over and over again, and you've seen it, we've all seen it,
yeah.
I said to myself, this is not the way to solve these problems. We've got to have a broader view. And so that, coupled with witnessing all of the factors that went into the kind of environment that either was healthful or not, I think became a part of my vision, and the strategies were always multifaceted. I went to business school because I realized that healthcare is a business, and if we don't understand how to interface with that way of thinking and to bring in people from the business community into the larger challenge of creating a healthy community, we are not likely to succeed.
And our patients are often that source of inspiration for us if we take that time to reflect on some of these interactions and the places that go right and the places that go wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
Can you tell me about a success or accomplishment that you're particularly proud of?
I love being able to stand back and say the numbers reflect what we've been trying to accomplish. So when I see the childhood obesity rates going down among children ages 2 to 5 who are eligible for, who had been eligible for WIC and are getting SNAP, I am thrilled. I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of seeing people talk about creating a culture of health and putting health in policies in a way that they hadn't before, and to see that in lots of communities. And just the other day I was listening to a little video clip on LinkedIn, and someone was using the words that we had used earlier in framing the culture of health. That's enormously rewarding. But the thing that's really rewarding for me is when I can see in an individual person or an individual family how a change in policy or something that we had envisioned at a large scale level affecting them personally. That's when it really becomes all worthwhile.
Risa, you've accomplished so much and been at the forefront of some of the most pressing issues and leading in that space, issues around healthcare reform. For our generation, it's the first time that we even really understood the possibility of what could happen, even though the successes would come later. You've championed making sure that all Americans are insured through your role at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation around childhood obesity. So many initiatives that for so many people, they might think that you've never made a mistake. And so I'm going to ask you about what was your most important error, mistake, or failing? And what did you learn from it, and how did you bring that forward?
Well, one of the hardest things that a leader has to do is to transition a program or a strategy, a direction from one direction to another, because invariably people are left behind. They are hurt in that process. And when, for very good reasons, I decided, and I'll take responsibility for the decision, to transition what had been a very popular program at the foundation, the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program, from one that focused solely on physicians and was based at one of up to 10 sites. It varied the number of sites that we had over the 30 years that we funded the program in that way. But we realized that having a program that only focused on physicians ignored the fact that leaders in healthcare and in health came from a variety of different clinical backgrounds, and that by locating a program that was building leaders and trying to shape the leadership for the next generation, having that based at only a few places automatically put up barriers for people who couldn't go to those institutions, who for whatever reasons were in a different environment. And so we decided to make a change, and we announced that we were going to make the change without having a fulsome description of what the new program would be. And what that did was it created a void where there was a lot of misunderstanding about what the possibilities were for the future. A lot of people took the opportunity to kind of dig in and say it's got to be the old way or no way. And it was painful, and it was more painful than I think it had to be. When I look in retrospect, I think if we had delayed the announcement, truncated the time that the transition would occur, and most importantly, had a much clearer statement and details about what was to come, we might have made that easier. It still probably would have been hard, but I think it might have been easier. And so from that, I learned that I learned to pay much more attention to the transition than I did prior to that, to be very clear that nothing is going to get announced in the way that we did until it's pretty clear where people can go, because they have to know that they're not just potentially giving something up, but they're there's a new direction that they can move towards.
Yeah, the management of change can be so taxing for a leader, and because you're holding both your feelings about the transition as well as the feelings of so many others, and having to manage that, and because you care about those people and the programs and the initiatives.
No leader is going to have a career without having to go through these transitions. It's a lesson I wish in some ways I had learned earlier.
I wanted to circle back to your mentors and sponsors. Can you talk about who have been your mentors, how they've supported you, and any other kinds of supports that you've had along the way?
Well, I mentioned having a division chief who was a very good leader, and he was willing to take the risk to give honest feedback. And I think a lot of times you don't get that to the degree that you need it from a mentor. I had other people. I like to describe a mentoring network or village, because I think that you need different kinds of skills in your mentoring network. So I had a few people who were really helpful in introducing me to other leaders, academics, and people who could then be a part of the development of my career. The people that were making these introductions were not necessarily mentoring me in a day-to-day way. They were very active in periodically asking me, you know, how can I help you connect with the people that will be helpful to you? I had a mentor who was really a family friend in Seattle who took it upon himself to just follow my career. He's a physician. He would read the journals, and if I published something, he would send me a little note. He always was trying to be proactive in describing some things that I might think about in the next 5 or 10 years. I think it's very important for me that I had a couple of people who really were good sponsors. I mentioned getting to HHS under Secretary Sullivan's administration, in part because I had a sponsor who took it upon himself to recommend me for that job. I wouldn't have gotten that job without him, and I wouldn't have gotten some of the opportunities that I had coming out of government if it weren't for a couple of other sponsors that I met while I was in government, people who were not in government themselves, but we just interacted, and they did things like recommend me for the first corporate board I was on. And that was particularly important for me in my later development, because as a board member, I got to observe how another CEO did his job, it was a he, and how the people on the board interacted and did their job of oversight and governance. That gave me a tremendous leg up.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. I had not thought about being able to use that experience to help prepare you for that leadership role. A really important set of experiences. Who or what are your sources of inspiration?
Probably my biggest source of inspiration was my mother. She's a pediatrician and managed to have a very active practice, be a successful leader of a medical clinic, and raise 4 children. And the older I got and the more I saw how hard it was to do even one of those.
Yes.
And I haven't had 4 children. You know, I often am inspired by people who do extraordinary things in an ordinary way. And so a lot of the people that inspire me on a day-to-day basis are the people that I see going about their lives and Obviously, doing it in a way that is designed to make the lives of the people around them better. Because ultimately, you know, we're all living in a network of a relatively small number of people, and if we can do that well, the benefits are tremendous.
And you know, also those that are doing that, and it's just sort of what they do. You know, it's always so interesting to me that sometimes folks are so unaware of how inspiring their lives can be, quote unquote, simple actions, but really in the face of sometimes the really remarkable adversity or challenge.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I'm like many others, I'm inspired by the great leaders of our day. I got the privilege of working closely with Michelle Obama on childhood obesity, and she is an absolutely inspiring leader because she's authentic. She cares deeply about the things she chooses to work on, and she chooses to work on important issues.
This has been so incredibly wonderful to have the time to talk with you, Risa. I want to transition to the questions that we're asking all of our guests. What are some of your hobbies, or what do you do for self-care?
I love to hike. It doesn't have to be a strenuous hike, but getting outside and walking is very rejuvenating for me. And there have actually been studies that describe walking outside, and particularly walking outside close to water, having a particularly positive health of, a benefit. And I do have a friend that I work out with, and we probably work out together 3 or 4 times a week. And that's important to me because it gives me a chance to connect with someone on a regular basis about whatever. We talk about everything under the sun and in no particular order, but we are there for each other both to keep us moving physically, but also to nurture each other emotionally and spiritually. And then I try to start every day with gratitude, getting in contact with the things that have happened the previous day for which I'm thankful, and the bigger things in life for which I'm thankful, because I believe that having gratitude is centers you in a way that's enormously important.
It sounds like you have a pretty strong practice and clarity about the things that keep you moving. What is your favorite leadership book or a leadership book that you would recommend?
For me, Jim Collins' Good to Great was a particularly important leadership book, even though it's not only talking about personal leadership, it's talking about the leadership of an organization. It was important because it describes how to change an organization so that it has higher and higher aspirations, so that it really does want to go from good to great and stay great, which means you've got to continually improve. And then I've, over the years, read various things about being a quiet leader, being an introverted person who's also a leader. Because in my early days, when I did not think of myself as a leader, I thought that largely because people always described me as quiet. And I've come to realize that that's exactly what people describe about me now as being one of the most effective parts of my leadership. You know, I need to also reserve a certain amount of time for myself to recharge, and that's consistent with being an introvert. So I had to kind of get an understanding of how I could be true to who I am as a person and be an effective leader as well.
Yeah. Really, really important, and something that really resonates with me, who also has that introverted preference. So I think once you figure that out as a leader and that has an introverted preference, a lot of things sort of fall in line for me in terms of the need for, I also love walking, and actually in residency in New Haven, would run and walk along the Long Island Sound as just a way to decompress. What are you reading or listening to now?
I'm reading two things at once, kind of. I'm reading, rereading Beloved, also reading The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates. They're both set in, a similar setting, a similar time in our nation's history, and tell a story of gaining power among, in one case, a woman, and in another case, a man, who are coming out of that horrible time of people being enslaved, of our people being enslaved. So those are two very interesting books for me. Now the writing is beautiful, it's so interesting that they are coming at this from two different perspectives, and yet similar themes emerge.
I have Beloved, but I need to get this newest novel by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Everything else that I've read of his has been nonfiction, so I'm really excited. What do you think separates good leaders from great leaders?
Great leaders listen and learn from what they hear, so that they can continue to understand more deeply, and evolve as leaders, but also evolve their strategies and their vision in a way that is responsive and accountable to what they've heard. But I'm always impressed that great leaders can really listen. They know how to listen.
Leading from behind, you have to have that ability to hear what's happening and to be in touch.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to your younger self?
There were so many forces and people saying I couldn't do it, that I almost didn't believe it when there were a few who told me I could. So believe in myself would be one thing. And the other is to nurture my network. I talked about the people that were influential and had been mentors and sponsors, but I didn't understand the importance of having a network and nurturing that, because those are going to be the people that will help you find new directions in the work, will be critical in ways that are important and helpful, and will be the people that you can then help you nurture the next generation. So nurturing a network is something that I didn't understand was as important as it is to being a strong and effective leader.
That's fantastic advice. Now I'm starting to think about my network, actually. Well, thanks again so much for joining us today, Risa. This has been a fabulous time to talk with you and to connect with you. And also thank you to our listeners. You've been listening to A Different Kind of Leader.
You have been listening to A Different Kind of Leader. If you like what you have heard, please rate us and leave a comment wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps others find us. Also, look for us on Facebook and Instagram at Different Kind of Leader, as well as Twitter at DK Leadership. You can also email us at differentkindofleader@gmail.com. Please let us know what leadership questions you have for guests and which inspiring leaders you would like for us to interview next.